Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, President of the American Family Association.
And welcome to the program. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today. He'll be back in this chair tomorrow for Trivia Friday. I am joined by my co-host, my affable and intellectually, I was going to say acute, but that sounds too much like I'm saying I like your hair. Ray Pritchard of Keep Believing Ministries. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Ed. Hey, I like that word, affable. So affable. It has a nice friendly ring to it, doesn't it? How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And you know what? That's all Christians should be about, is just that, being, we just need to be affable. We need to be likable.
Just be nice.
Be nice.
Go into all the world and be nice.
Oh, hey, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard, the Babylon Bee? It's kind of a Christian, for those who don't know, Christian satirical website, kind of like The Onion. Right. Which is very funny, but can be a little bit off color at times. Mm. That's a secular one. The Babylon Bee is a Christian satirical website, and they have a story last week. It said that some of the modern hymnals have included the song "I Surrender Some."
Right.
Because I surrender all. Just too much for Christians.
It's just too negative. That's so hard to do. I surrender some and get on with it.
Surrender some and I'm nice. What more do you want from
me?
So anyway, Ray, we've got a lot to talk about. We have Fred Jackson, who's news director for American Family News and One News Now, in the studio. Fred, you're from Canada. You're nice automatically, right?
Absolutely. And I was just looking up here while you two gentlemen were talking about affable. It's right there in Hezekiah.
Yes, that's right. That's one of the forgotten books of the Old Testament.
I found it. I found that forgotten book. Thou shalt be affable.
Thou shalt be affable.
It was there.
You know, and it starts off with a big smiley face on it, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. In the new revised version.
Yeah, we're being a little facetious, folks, but we are going to talk about some stories today, probably next segment. Some global evangelical leaders very disappointed in Christians and this country for the election of Donald Trump. And, well, I mean, that's to be expected. This election seems to have divided everybody. But anyway, we're going to talk about some of those kinds of things in the next segment. But, Fred, we do want to talk about the protests. Now, in the immediate aftermath of what was – no doubt a shocking election result for many pollsters, many of the pundits in the mainstream media, I'm sure for the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party. The election of Donald Trump was a shock, and in the immediate aftermath, there were some protests. My wife asked me, she said, what do you think about these protests? And I said, they'll probably go on for maybe a day or two. That's just kind of part of the fallout. But these things are continuing, and not only are colleges involved, but high schools, at least in some parts of the country.
Yeah, let's go back, guys, to what was it, the third debate? It was toward the end of, was it Chris Wallace that asked the two, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, about the results of the election?
Right.
What will be your reaction should you lose? And Donald Trump said, I may not accept the results. Well, you remember the reaction to that? That was the end of the debate. And even on Fox News, they were saying, this is going to be the headlines tomorrow morning. Donald Trump says he won't accept the results of the election. And it was. It was the headlines everywhere.
Sort of sinister motives were assigned to Trump because of that statement.
Exactly. That became the big story coming out of that final debate for many, many people, particularly Trump's political enemies. Well, here we are. We're, 9 days after the election? Donald Trump won the election. And look at what we are seeing out there. There are thousands and thousands of, a lot of them students, some of them professors in universities, but now, as you mentioned, down to the high school level, they're taken to the streets. And we're seeing incidents like one yesterday in Rockville, Maryland, and it was Richard Montgomery High School. I guess the teachers had no problems there. They let the students out at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they hit the streets protesting. Well, one of the kids, a 15-year-old kid there, had a cap on, and it said something along the line, you know, make America great again.
Right. The Trump slogan for his campaign.
The Trump slogan. Eyewitnesses say this young man, 15 years old, was not arrogant. He was not provocative. He wasn't trying to pick a fight. But what happened was that four of the students there attacked him. They beat on him, got him down, and kicked him unmercilessly. And he had to be taken to hospital afterwards. Fortunately, he is okay. But this is what has happened, and it's reminiscent of what happened in Chicago several days ago, where a motorist was attacked, hauled out of his car, badly beaten, and the video is still out there. You can see it on YouTube, saying he voted for Trump. Voted for Trump, and they stole his car.
I got a couple of questions about this for you guys. I mean, on the school side of things, isn't there a law? Aren't students supposed to be in school? I mean, is it legal for them to just say we're going to dismiss the students for a political protest or what?
Yeah, this is part of the story now that's coming out. A story we were going to try to fit in yesterday, but we just didn't have time. This was history teachers at another New York City high school, Beacon Hill High School in Manhattan. 200 students were let out by history teachers. Now, here's the thing that's happening. English teachers said, no, you can't go out. History teachers let these kids go out. The official to a protest. And these protests, by the way, are already planned, and the teachers are allowing the kids to join them. The official word is that the New York City Department of Education officials said that students were not officially allowed to cut classes. Not only that, parents were not told that their kids were being let out of school to go to a protest. Now, what happens to kids who get beaten up, or if a kid accidentally steps in front of a car and gets hurt? And the parents go, well, what in the world was my son or daughter doing out at a protest? What if these things turn violent as adults clash? This is a strange occurrence. Most of us, I'm talking about Fred and Ray, we grew up, saw the protests of the 60s. Those were on college campuses now.
Right.
The, I guess, former protesters from the 60s who are now high school teachers are engaging high school kids without parents' permission. This is taking protests to a whole new level.
Well, so Ed, in the scenario you gave us, if something had happened to one of those students, would the school not be legally culpable? I mean, that's the case that would be made, right?
Oh, so I think they would absolutely be liable. The teachers would be liable. Parents were not. You know, if kids, I assume still even in high school, if you're going to leave the campus, you have to get permission from your parents or legal guardians. So if they're going to the mall or they're going on a field trip or whatever they call them nowadays, you have to have permission. And if parents have not given permission for that to happen, absolutely the schools could be sued.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I have another story to talk about here. This is a Fox News story this morning. The headline, San Francisco Teachers Union offers Trump lesson plan. San Francisco's public schools have been offered a classroom lesson plan that calls President-elect Donald Trump a racist, sexist man who became president by, quote, pandering to a huge racist and sexist base. Now, this lesson plan, so-called, has been put together by the 16,000-member teachers union there in San Francisco. And it may be put out to the 57,000 students in that school district. The school district spokeswoman, Gentile Blythe, I think it is, said the plan is optional and not part of the official curriculum. Note, she is not saying this will never make it into the classroom. She's just kind of leaving it up to the teachers. It's the teachers' union that has put this curriculum together.
Well, and here's these kinds of stories, as you dig deeper and deeper, you clearly see the motivation of the adults who are involved in this. This lesson plan was written by a social studies teacher named Fakhra Shah. I don't know if that was the name. But anyway, she said she hadn't planned to spread it citywide. She said she wrote it at 2 a.m. November 9th, just hours after the results came in. I'm reading now from a Fox News story. It says, to help teachers at her school struggling with how to answer students' questions and concerns about Trump becoming president. Now, listen, I've watched enough Law and Order episodes to be able to peer in and see the flaws in this lady's explanation. There had not been any questions from students yet. It was the night of the election. No, these were her questions. These were the things she wanted to communicate to students that are being held captive in government schools. And so her attempt to pawn this off on the students, saying my students would have all these questions, I would need to answer them, so I wrote this curriculum. This is a bunch of baloney, but this clearly reveals to me, Ray, it's not a sudden revelation, that the secular progressives in this country, and this goes to a story we're going to try to get to here before this segment is over in terms of President Obama's remarks overseas, secular progressives, they believe that the majority of adults in this country are either too stupid or too set in their ways to realize just how great the secular progressive mindset is. So they're going after the kids. And you know what? On college campuses and in a lot of urban settings in the public school systems, they have a captive audience.
You know, Ed and Fred, for one thing, it's when this happens on the college campuses, well, we're not that surprised, right? Because college campuses are a hotbed for for dissent and demonstration. It's quite a different thing when it's happening in the high school and the junior high school. And in that Fox News article that you mentioned, they actually link to the lesson plan so you can read it for yourself. And it says, by this Fakhra Shah, it says, let us please not sidestep the fact that a racist and sexist man has become the president of our country by pandering to a huge racist and sexist base. I mean, forget the fact that's dripping with elitist condescension. Forget the fact that she wrote it. I think, or that this person wrote it, I think the shocking thing and the thing that ought to concern us is that the teachers' union thought it a good idea to take a basically piece of left-wing propaganda and put it forth as a teaching plan a couple of hours after Donald Trump was elected president. Is this not the very definition of what educational subversion is all about?
Oh, I think that's exactly what's happening, and I don't think this started with Donald Trump. This has been going on for a long, long time. I think... And I'm not speaking for every school across the country, so let's be clear about that. There are some fine Christian teachers and some fine schools out there that are not involved with this kind of thing. However, notice these protests, for the most part, are occurring in very large centers.
Right.
It would be interesting to overlap where these protests are occurring with the mayors of the so-called sanctuary cities that have come out and said, we're not going to allow the feds to come in here and take out people who have entered the country illegally. It would be very interesting to overlap those two things. But here's the problem. This has been going on for a long, long time. We all know that these kinds of protests would not have occurred if Hillary Clinton won.
Right.
If anything, there would have been dancing in the streets and celebrations, and kids would have gotten the day off to celebrate.
Right.
And there would not have been any objection, and the mainstream media would promote it that way. But the mainstream media is not asking the questions that we are kind of tending towards here this morning. Where are the kids getting these ideas? Is it the job of the teachers' unions and the teachers to basically promote dissent against the properly elected, soon-to-be president of the United States? this ought to be a concern. I mean, you are a parent listening to this program. You better be checking out with your school district, your school board members, your trustees, your teachers at your schools. Are you okay with this kind of thing? It may not be happening, may not be protests at your school, but it's worth the inquiry. Where is this stuff coming from? And we know, I believe, because we've been covering these stories for some time now, that this is an orchestrated, this is a well-thought-out effort. Come on. The teachers' union put millions and millions of dollars aside to help get Hillary Clinton right. elected. That's known. That's a fact. That's not supposition.
Right.
We heard a report yesterday, listening to Tony Perkins yesterday afternoon. He had, Penny Nance on, of Concerned Women for America. She was saying there are reports out there that Planned Parenthood is funding some of these protests. In other words, they're paying some people to go to these protests. Now, this is the kind of thing that's going on out there that ought to set off alarms. And it goes beyond these protests that you're seeing on TV. We heard a very sad report this morning. This is an incident involving a Christian family. The Sunday after the election, they had a call from their adult son.
Right.
Asked mom and dad, who did you vote for? And they said, Donald Trump. All right, mom and dad, my family, he's married, kids, we're not coming to your house for Christmas because we don't think your house, your place, is a safe environment. That was the term used, safe. Now, this is what it's coming to. These kinds of languages being used, and families are being divided over this election. And notice the language being used, safe. That's not the first time we've heard that
right,
word.
That's right.
Word used. I mean, we have universities setting up so-called safe places for students who feel somehow that their lives are in jeopardy because Donald Trump has been elected president.
Well, listen, as far as I can tell, the only people in this country who are not safe are the Trump supporters, like this 15-year-old boy who was beaten. It is the business owners who own businesses where protesters are being actually bussed in from outside the community to riot. And they're not protests. These are riots. If you're a small business owner in these areas, you don't feel safe. It is part of the secular progressive movement in this country, frankly, because it is rooted in Marxism. This is my belief. It's rooted in Marxism, but this is the way Marxists and secular progressives operate. You go all the way back to George Orwell, his Orwellian speech in 1984, Big Brother, and the speech that is, you say one thing, but it actually means something else. Safe doesn't really mean safe. It means you are in danger if you disagree with us.
You know, one of the things that's happened throughout all this is that the real motives of the folks on the left, those motives, their battle plan has been so clearly revealed. Obviously, they had invested, as you guys said, not just millions, but tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. They were utterly certain, underline, utterly certain Hillary Clinton was going to win. Completely unprepared for what happened last Tuesday night. Completely unready. And so when Trump turns out to be the next president, the only conclusion they can come to is America must be racist and sexist because there's no other explanation for why people would vote for a man like that. Well, no wonder, Fred, there's division in our nation when you impute not just bad motives, but the worst possible motives, not just to a few, because there are bad apples out there, right?
Right.
But when you impute that kind of thing to, what, 62 million people who voted for Donald Trump, no wonder our nation is fragmenting. That is unfair, and it's dangerous.
Well, Fred, tell us a little bit about, I know we're running out of time here for this segment, but President Obama, while he was in Athens, Greece, called for course correction on globalization. Now, this is more of this doublespeak, okay? This is more of this left wing, here's what I'm saying, but if you understand me, here's what I mean, okay? Tell us a little bit about his calls for course correction on globalization.
Oh, yeah, course correction. He's not saying Maybe we ought to rethink globalization. No, 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 no. What he's really saying there is that we have not done a good job of educating, to use the term that came up in the election, deplorables.
Right.
They are the problem. So the concept is not the problem. The globalization, that's not the problem. The problem is that we haven't done a good enough job of educating. And some people took that as as Obama taking a personal swipe at Hillary Clinton. She did a bad job of selling what Obama believes is his wonderful legacy. And that's what he's going to in that. But I want to mention also, all these protests going on, some of them violent, riots out there, I have not heard one word, a call from our existing president, President Barack Obama, saying stop this.
Right.
Stop this.
And incidentally, Donald Trump, when he was interviewed on CBS by Leslie Stahl, she attacked him like an attack dog, saying, the people out there who are making these threats, will you tell them to stop it? I mean, she demanded an answer from him. And so when it comes, I haven't read about any of these Trump supporters, you know, burning down, you know, buildings and getting into scraps with the police or beating up 15-year-olds. So where is Leslie Stahl asking the president or Hillary Clinton to look into the camera and say, stop it?
Hillary Clinton gave a speech last night to a group of her supporters. It's the first time first public speaking since the election. Not a word. In fact, what she said, you need to go work harder and harder for what we believe in. But not a word about these riots and protests. Not a word about saying, hey, listen, democracy was in play here. We have a new president of the United States. Let's try to work with him. Let's give him a chance. Let's calm down here. Nothing of that kind of comment has come from either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. And I call that negligence on the part of these leaders. No question about it. As Hillary Clinton mentioned in her speech last night, there were 62 million people who voted for her. Where's the leadership? She's still a leader.
Right.
Where's the leadership being shown here to calm down? You may not like the results, but calm down. We're going forward here, and we will continue to make our point on our ideology. But the way to do it is not these protests and riots.
Well, Fred, isn't the implication here then that by not speaking out, isn't the implication, or can't we fairly infer, maybe say it that way, that the president and Secretary Clinton are not displeased with all these demonstrations? I mean, if they were displeased, wouldn't they speak out? So doesn't their silence at least give us permission to infer that they're okay with what's happening so far?
Oh, that's not a stretch at all. It's not a stretch at all. We know these two people, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. They're not afraid to speak their mind.
Right.
They're not afraid to come out and say, this is wrong, that is wrong. So you're exactly right, Ray. The fact that they have not said anything, we are led to believe they're okay with this.
Well, a lot of people, we're running out of time in this segment. We can explore it some other time. But, you know, both of them, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, big fans of Saul Alinsky.
Yeah.
Okay. Rules for radicals. This is the humanist way, what we're seeing. This is the Marxist way to try to take control of cultures and intimidate your opposition into silence. Well, folks, we're going to take a short break and continue our discussion and talk about a couple of other issues that have arisen. What do global evangelical leaders think about what's happened in America? And you may remember the name Jen Hatmaker. Well, there's a pretty big story behind her popularity and what is happening in the evangelical church when it comes to women teachers. And we're going to look into those issues after the break. You're listening to Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network after a few-minute break. Again, a few minutes break. We'll be back with more on Today's Issues.
King of the Wild Frontier.
The music's free. I know we call it Learning University.
Of necessity.
Trivia Friday.
True.
Ding, ding, ding,
yes.
Ding, ding.
Oh, really?
That's correct. Giraffes do not have vocal cords.
So you want a cheeseburger without cheese.
Hold this. called the
G. I said, yes, ma'am, whatever you call it.
Take a break with Tim Wildman and the gang. Friday mornings at 10 Central on American Family Radio.
Hey, our Holy Land tour in March is filling up. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We only go one time a year to Israel, and that's in March. And our tour leaves the 9th and gets back on the 17th. And as I say, we don't have a whole lot of space left on this tour. So if you'd like to go with us and see the Holy Land, you need to give us a call at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, with an S, option 5, and leave us your name and your address. We'll send you a brochure. Or go online at twholyland.com, twholyland.com. Again, we're going to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Jericho and Nazareth and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River, all those places and much, much more. So join us on this very special tour of Israel in March.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next. For a number of years now, I've been warning you that our public schools have been turned into radical indoctrination centers, teaching kids to hate America. This indoctrination gave birth to a cultural and sexual revolution that swept across the fruited plain. And sadly, many conservatives, many good church-going Americans did nothing. They were silent in the face of evil. And now another revolution is brewing, this one targeting the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. In recent days, protests have been festering on high school and college campuses aimed at delegitimizing the presidential election. But this revolution can be put down by we the people, by taking back our public schools and sending a message to the far left that school is about reading, writing, and arithmetic, not pillaging, plundering, and pandering. I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today, and I am joined I always call him affable, but Ray Pritchard of Keep Believing Ministries. Hey, Ray, tell the listeners a little bit about Keep Believing Ministries, where they can go, what they can find at your website.
Well, we are an online free biblical resource center for Christians in America and around the world. If you come to keepbelieving.com, keepbelieving.com, you'll find tons, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sermons, Bible studies, outlines, videos, podcasts, all devoted to helping you understand the Word of God and be equipped to share it with other people. We want to help people believe in Jesus and then give them courage and strength to keep believing in Him.
Well, folks, I always highly recommend Ray Pritchard, not simply because I think because I consider him a friend of mine, but because he's just an outstanding Bible teacher. So head out to keepbelieving.com, Keep Believing Ministries, and check out and see what Ray has there. All right, hey, I think we're going to be talking with Alistair Begg in just a few moments. You probably, if you're an AFR Talk listener, you've heard the teaching, fine Bible teaching of Alistair Begg. Fred, while we still have you here for this segment, we were talking a little bit during the break. We were listening to Todd Stearns. He was talking about we can make dramatic changes in this country by taking back our public schools, which even though we have said many times on this program, there are some fine public schools, some fine public school teachers, many of whom I think are called to do that, as a gifting from God. But there's no doubt that the public school system as one single institution has been largely captured by secular progressives. One of the things that's going to be critical in the Trump administration is his approach to public education and how parents can take this, break up the cartel, so to speak, the monopoly that these secular forces have on the education system.
Yeah, no question about it. It is a priority for this incoming administration. Vice President-elect Pence as governor of Indiana, has been a major proponent of the voucher system. And basically, this ought to be not a...
Explain, first of all, let me interrupt, what vouchers, what that means for
vouchers
those who don't
basically
know.
Would work this way. States have an idea of how much they spend per student to educate a student. And so in the voucher system, instead of that check being written to the public school, the parent would be given the option of sending their kid to a charter school, a Christian school, whatever the case may be, and they would receive that check for that amount.
Right.
Let's say the public school spends $10,000 a year on a given student. Okay, the check would be, the parent would have the right to say, I want to send my Johnny or Jane over here. And
the money would follow.
The money would follow them. And so he has been a major advocate of that kind of thing. And here's what's going to happen. Now, of course, the mainstream, the diehard public school system has been obviously very opposed to that.
Oh, they'll fight this to the death.
They will. So they've been very opposed to this, but here's what's happening. And these protests may work in favor of promoting the idea of voucher systems, because parents are looking at this and they're saying, you know, I send my kid to school to learn to read and write, as Todd Starnes was just talking about it. My school is not doing that.
Right.
It is obviously my school is spending a whole lot of time on teaching an ideology that I don't agree with.
Right.
So... either there are two things that can happen. I was out in California a couple of weeks ago attending an event for the Pacific Justice people out there, and about 1,000 people there. And at my table that night, there were two ladies, moms, who for the first time were running for office. We're running to be members of our school board because
right.
we are so, and you can imagine California, what's going on out there. But we're so upset with what's going on. And talking to our school board members is not doing it, so we're going to run.
Great.
So this is one way to do it. The other way is to really promote the idea of a voucher system. I think you now have people in the going into the White House that are going to be very friendly to that idea. And it's a way to hold your local school board accountable. Find out. It's very important. This again, goes back to mom and dad. Find out where your school district is with their ideology. You know, if I was up there Rockville, Maryland, where this protest occurred yesterday, and I'm concerned about that, I said, wait a minute, I didn't want my Johnny or Jane let out. I believe I'm paying taxes for you to teach them history and English.
Right.
What are they doing out in the street right now? And you're encouraging this kind of thing. I would hold them accountable. And if they're telling you, hey, you're one of those deplorables, we're not going to listen to you. All right, then fine. I want a voucher system. And I want to send my kids. You will remember how Barack Obama fought the voucher system in Washington, D.C.
Even though a majority of blacks in that city, black yes. parents, wanted choice for themselves.
Yes, they wanted the same choice that President Barack Obama elected for himself and his wife, Michelle, to send their two daughters to a private school.
Right.
They wanted that option. They wanted the option to take the taxpayers' money that they pay. They wanted the option to send to the same school that Barack Obama has sent his two daughters to.
Right.
They wanted
you
that
know,
option.
One of the things that isn't being said in the bigger discussion is that the Trump plan is going to be a boon and a blessing to children in the inner cities.
Yes.
You know, if you live out in the prosperous suburbs, right, you may have you're going to have a completely different school situation. But if you live in Cleveland, if you live in Chicago, if you live in parts of Philadelphia, I mean, we're just sad to say this, but in some of the urban areas, Detroit, for instance, inner city Detroit, you're taking your life in your hands to go into some of these public schools. The whole point of charter schools, private schools, parochial schools, the voucher system is to give families, especially in the inner city, who do not have the financial resources, to give them genuine educational choice. Nobody's against that except the big public school teachers' unions, and they're trying to protect their own territory.
And here's why. You say, why would the teachers' union be opposed to that? Well, here's why. Because right now they have a monopoly on the public school system, and the National Education Association is extremely liberal, and they want to continue with their indoctrination of America's children, because eventually those children will replace all these stubborn and ignorant adults. And I'm just telling you, that is their mentality. I've written articles on specific issues where those kinds of statements are made. And the only way to break that, Fred, as we've been talking about, is vouchers. Because the only here's the scenario. Like you're talking about these kids going out, when the kids are being indoctrinated on homosexuality and transgenderism, and schools are saying, no, we're going to let boys go into girls' dressing rooms and locker rooms if they want to. The only thing that's going to change that is when, you know, half the parents say, well, fine, go ahead. I'm taking my kids down the road to a school that's not doing that. That's when that foolishness will stop. That is when, because these teachers, for example, who believe it's their duty to indoctrinate children about socialism and so on and so forth, when those teachers stubbornly refuse to stop doing it because kids are draining out of the school, they'll get fired, and they will get replaced by teachers who are willing to teach math and science and history and those kinds of things. So anyway, education is becoming a really big issue here as the Trump presidency moves forward. We will certainly keep an eye on that. Fred, we're going to let you go for a few minutes at least, and we want to welcome Alistair Begg, who's senior pastor at Parkside Church near Cleveland, Ohio. His radio program, Truth for Life, is heard on AFR Talk weekdays at 11:30 Central Time and Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Central Time. Alistair, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Listen, we've been talking about, we just got done talking about a little bit about education and the concept of choice. We want to talk to you about a couple of other things in just a moment, but I'd like to get your thoughts about the public school system there in Cleveland, Ohio. We always, you know, put forth the caveat, there are plenty of good public schools in our country, fine public school teachers. But do you think it's an overstatement to say that the public school system in general has been placed under the control of those from the ideological left of the spectrum?
Well, you know, I would defer to people who've got a bigger grasp of the thing than me. We are in a small community here on the east side of Cleveland, where, the structure of the immediate environment, the engagement of people with the teachers on a social level, and on just in the ebb and flow of community life, is probably a little different from some of the other places. But there's no question to me that the overwhelming view of the world that is pervasive, that is inevitably represented in these arenas, is not one that is going to set forward biblical values and the things that we as believing people would hold dear.
Yes.
So I think a lot of it has to do with who the people are, who are the decision makers in the individual schools. You know, if you have a brave principal who is not trying to turn the school into a Billy Graham crusade, but nevertheless is prepared to hold the line in relationship to some of these things, you have a chance. But absent that, then no, I think it is exactly as you say, that it's just a slow slide into a kind of moral morass.
Well, let's kind of switch gears here and kind of jump off that, because I think that more Christians are becoming aware of the word and the idea behind the word worldview, that it's important not just what the core beliefs of people are, but what those core beliefs lead them to think about the way we should live. Alistair, I want to mention an article that was in this week's Christianity Today. It's actually from 2 days ago. Christianity Today had an article. Here's the headline: Global Evangelical Leaders, Trump's Win Will Harm the Church's Witness. And It starts off, some evangelical leaders around the globe worry that the recent U.S. presidential election has damaged Christian moral witness and will fuel discord abroad. Now, I can mention a few of the points that are made by some of our brothers from around the world, but here is it in a nutshell, as far as I can tell. There seems to be a divide in evangelical Christianity here and abroad as to what the place of politics is in the life of a Christian who lives in a democratic or republic, those kinds of forms of government, and what Christians should do with regards to people they disagree with. Can you speak to either of those issues?
Well, I mean, it's inevitable that there will be differences in perspective, but I don't really know what that means. My take on the political landscape vis-a-vis the church is that the opportunities that are represented in the wholesale shift that there's been in this election, from my perspective, at least gives us the opportunity to see the realigning of certain things, the retaking of certain things, to put things back on a far more level playing field, at least, in terms of public morality, in terms of the place of the unborn, in terms of people whose understanding of God and of the Constitution and so on is in line with what we would have regarded it as being in terms of its original formation. So I think that's a plus. I think it could be regarded as a minus if, once again, Christianity becomes aligned simply with, you know, a political persuasion. Because Christianity is always at its best historically when it's countercultural. So it's a delicate balance in these things where in rejoicing in certain elements of it, I don't want then to baptize the whole thing into a level of orthodoxy, because I realize that the concerns of God's kingdom will not always intersect with my concerns for Scotland or for the United States or whatever it might be. And that's why the privileges of democracy are such that as individuals, we have the freedom to do as has been done in this election. And pastors, I think, need to be a lot more careful in their public statements than many of us have been.
So, Alistair, let me just jump on what you just said, because everybody seems to agree that the evangelical church is as deeply divided at this point, I mean deeply divided, as we have ever been as a result of this election. How could you have voted? How come you didn't vote? How could you have, we are at each other's throats. And in some cases, that has come down into the local church. In the face of this kind of division, and I'm not speaking of, say, the networks and so on, or people out in the streets, I'm talking about inside the evangelical church, where there are legitimate differences, or at least deeply felt differences of opinion. How do we go forward from here?
Well, you know, in prospect of this election, you know, what I've tried to say again and again to my congregation is to remember that the issues of the kingdom of God are the issues that he sets up authorities, he brings them down. The nations are to God, from one perspective, as a drop in a bucket, as the fine dust in the balance. Every empire that has raised itself, whether it's the Greek, Roman, or British Empire, including the American Empire, will eventually crumble in some way and in some form. And throughout the world today, far beyond the immediate concerns of evangelical Christians in America, there's a vast world. I mean, 3,000 people have escaped this week from Libya trying to get into Italy. Over 300 of them, including children, have drowned again in the Mediterranean Sea. That is happening all the time. And and the concerns of our brethren in, for example, North Korea under that totalitarian regime is significant. The folks who are living in Cairo under Islam and so on. In other words, when we realize that God's purpose is to put together a people that no one can number from every tribe, nation, people, language, and tongue, and our focus then is on the gospel, then at least the fact that I may disagree with somebody in terms of political success or failure is then subservient to that reality. My problem here in America, and I've been here for 33 years, is, and the reason for the division, is because I don't think that the issues of the kingdom have been so pervasively adopted by evangelical Christianity in America so as to allow people to disagree over those things and yet to hold true to kingdom values. I think what you're now seeing is that people have wrapped their Christianity around whatever form it is that they've embraced. And so you've got this, you know, sort of large Christian socialist notion, and then you've got, you know, baptizing capitalism in is the only possible way. You know, John Stott, the late John Stott, on one occasion, he said, you know, under socialism, you know, people exploit their fellow man, whereas under capitalism, the reverse is the case. You know, in other words, there is no political system that is absolutely sacrosanct. It's inevitably flawed. And the concern of the church is the concern of the values of the kingdom. Now, when those values are worked out in the school system, in the high courts, in the matters of public morality, we as Christians have a responsibility to stand up for those things that the Bible upholds and to oppose those things that the Bible opposes. And where they align with certain political parties, so be it. But we have to uphold those things.
We're talking with Alistair Begg, who's senior pastor at Parkside Church near Cleveland, Ohio. His radio program, Truth for Life, is heard on AFR Talk weekdays at 11:30 Central Time. In fact, it comes right after this program, and Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Central Time. Ray, did you want to jump in with a follow-up?
Alistair, say something then about moving away from the election and politics. But you've been here in the U.S., as you said, for 33 years. If you had to look at our culture now, where do you see America as a culture now? And what's the spiritual condition of our nation as far as you're able to discern it?
Well, once again, it's hard to generalize, isn't it? Because it's a bit like when you take soil borings, you know,
right,
in preparation for a building. You know, some areas are soft and some areas are firmer and so on. So one has to be careful of that. I think on the one hand, you know, I see the evidence of a kind of biblical illiteracy where people have not really understood the Bible, have not understood the implications of the Bible, both in terms of personal reality and public morality. You've got the tremendous hue and cry over the understandable hue and cry over the homosexual issue. And yet, by and large, the evangelical church has egg on its face because of the free pass that it has given to so many in relationship to the destruction of marriage, in terms of divorce, in terms of professed Christian young people engaging in sex outside of marriage. In other words, the decay is already in the system. And so only, I think, a real kind of 18th century awakening along the lines of Whitfield and so on is going to be able to bring the evangelical, the genuine Christian witness in the country, you know, back to where it needs to be. So I'm not pessimistic, I'm optimistic. But I think that the numbers that are bandied about are representative of a kind of level of superficiality that would reveal itself as soon as the pressure of the state came against it.
Do you think that it's possible, Alistair, that we could have, say, a third great awakening here in America, or have we gone too far?
No, we've never gone too far. I mean, if you think about Great Britain in it, before you know Whitfield and Wesley, if you think about how dark that place was, and the children being put up chimneys, and life was just in absolute shreds, and yet God, you know, moved in that place. So no, we look for that. I look for that. I pray to that end. But you know, when that happens, then things will be changed from the inside out, not from the outside in. You know, when people's lives are changed by the gospel, then their view of the world will change with it. The problem with evangelical Christianity in America, if I can say so humbly, is it's been trying to work it from the outside in. But you can't. You know, only God can change the human heart. How do you get teachers that will stand up for public morality unless they themselves are changed from the inside? And so that's what we look for in our churches, and so that we are making an impact on our children as we educate them, as we teach them, as we send them into the mainstream of life in university and in politics and in science. You know, that's where we look for God to show himself strong.
Alistair, let me just add, we just got a couple minutes left, so let me just ask you to address this one last question. What would you say to the people out there who are listening, who are in churches where maybe they suspect that their minister is not changed? I'm not saying he's not saved, but he's not preaching the full counsel of God. Maybe he doesn't, you know, teach about the kingdom. What would you say to those people? What should they be doing if they are in a situation like that where they say something's rotten in Denmark, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you fly on a plane, they always say, in the unlikely event of a loss of cabin pressure, these things will fall from the roof. And if you are traveling with somebody who needs your help, make sure you put your own mask on first before trying to help another.
Right.
And I think in a very simple way, and yet in an important way, it is imperative that a genuine Christian is within the framework of a local church where the Bible is taught and believed and applied and unequivocally so. And I would say to the person, if you are aware that that is not the case, then start to look for somewhere where it is the case. Because don't think for a moment that you're going to be able to put somebody else's mask on if you starve of oxygen yourself. Right. And that may seem almost heartless or too cut and dried, but that's really it. I mean, if you have access to a minister and he's your friend and you play golf with him and you're able to be an encouragement to him and you can give him, you know, a genuine word of friendship that is both corrective and directive, that's one thing. But if that's not the case, then I would be on the lookout for somewhere where I can sit under the Bible with confidence.
Alistair Begg has been our guest. He's senior pastor at Parkside Church near Cleveland, Ohio. His radio program, Truth for Life, is heard on AFR Talk weekdays at 11:30 Central Time. It will follow this show, in fact, and Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Central Time. Pastor, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks for the privilege, Ed. Thank you, Ray.
All right, folks, we are going to take a short break, 5-minute break for news. You're listening to Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. We're going to be welcoming Fred Jackson back in just a few minutes after the break, talk about a few more issues of interest to you, things that are happening in our culture. So please rejoin us after this 5-minute break.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.